You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, three Republican lawmakers in Wisconsin are proposing lowering the drinking age to 19. We'll ask what you think. First, politicians, big businesses, and some of the richest people in the world have sheltered their wealth in offshore tax havens. That's according to the Paradise Papers, millions of files that were leaked to the press and show where the world's wealthy are sheltering their money. Reports say the papers reveal previously unknown transactions by the Queen of England, corporate giants like Nike and Apple, even key people in President Trump's circle. John Swain is a senior reporter for The Guardian. He's been covering the Paradise Papers. John, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, it's this whole world that people under a certain income level would have no reason to have contact with. Can you tell us just a little bit about what kind of institutions are at the center of these leaked documents?
Well, as you say, this is a mixture of big corporations, of ultra-wealthy individuals, and banks and other institutions who are finding the newest and cleverest ways to move money offshore, to move money away from the IRS and away from U.S. tax liability.
And a lot of names are being attached to this. As I understand it, it doesn't necessarily mean if my name came up in this, and it won't, but if it did, it wouldn't mean I had done anything illegal necessarily. Is that right?
That's right. In the vast majority of cases, this is the system. This is not illegal. This is the system that's been set up and that is being used, and some might argue exploited, by people who have the best and most expensive advisors and lawyers who find loopholes and weaknesses and new systems within the international banking and tax system to move their clients' money into the absolutely most efficient, tax-efficient location.
So it might be to avoid taxes. It might be because someone doesn't want their name associated with a business. Is it potentially a haven for money laundering as well?
Well, we know that these places often are. You know, many of the people we've written about in this project are obviously not involved in anything like that. They are just seeking to sort of maximize returns. But the secrecy that you mentioned that exists in some tax havens where filings are not made public, annual accounts do not need to be filed to the government authorities, and no kind of registration or disclosure paperwork is required, means that it's very easily exploited by people who are involved in criminal wrongdoing to hide the paper trail behind them. And that's why a lot of campaigners think that these tax havens are just incredibly bad for law enforcement around the world. You know, they allow people to just operate in this sort of shadow system.
Talking to John Swain from The Guardian, looking at the Paradise Papers leaked documents about banking institutions, money being hidden in these institutions by corporations and individuals. And John, you've been covering people in the American political system whose name has come up in ways more or less benign. Let's start in the U.S. cabinet. We've seen names like Secretary of State Rex Tillerson mentioned in some of the leaked files. How is he coming up there?
So Rex Tillerson is mentioned in a couple of documents in the files. He, as many people know, worked at ExxonMobil, the oil and gas sort of giant corporation, for many years, ending up as the CEO. And one entity that he appears in the files in relation to is a gas drilling venture that Exxon undertook in Yemen in the 1990s, when he was actually head of the Yemen division. And this was a controversial venture that they pursued in Yemen and eventually were sort of driven out of the country by the government. Rex Tillerson's name is attached to this offshore investment vehicle that Exxon used, we think, to sort of avoid U.S. tax, perhaps, and to ensure confidentiality of their documents. He appears in a couple of documents in relation to that venture.
And then Steven Mnuchin, the U.S. Treasury Secretary.
So before he joined the
government. Bank, I should say, yeah.
That's right. So Steven Mnuchin, before he joined the Trump administration, he was the deputy chairman of a bank named Citibank. And his name doesn't appear itself in the documents, but his bank does. And his bank, until recently, helped high net worth individuals, as they say, wealthy people, organize their ownership of private jets offshore, specifically to avoid things like sales taxes and charges that sometimes are applied by some U.S. states, by some European countries. Instead, if you register these jets in offshore tax havens, you can sometimes avoid those charges, which obviously, if you're buying a jet for, say, $50 million, add up to quite a lot of money.
And then before we leave the cabinet, Wilbur Ross, the Commerce Secretary, he's the one who's gotten the most attention for the Paradise Papers. What have we learned about him?
What we learned from the files with Wilbur Ross is that he's actually involved in a business venture with Russian President Vladimir Putin's son-in-law. Wilbur Ross has a stake in a shipping company named Navigator. Navigator does a lot of business with a Russian gas company named Seabur. And Seabur is co-owned by Kirill Shamalov, who is Putin's son-in-law. And this wasn't known before, and Secretary Ross has actually retained this stake since joining the government. He's continued to essentially to make money from this shipping company, which is operating in Russia with not only Vladimir Putin's son-in-law, but a couple of people who are actually under U.S. sanctions.
Is it a concern that he didn't disclose this, or did he disclose this, and we're just finding out about it?
So he did disclose in his original paperwork that he held a stake in a company named Navigator. What he didn't make perfectly clear, and what some ethics experts say is troubling, is that he was holding on to that. He declared that he was holding on to these quite obscurely named investment vehicles in places like the Cayman Islands. And unbeknownst to a lot of people, these actually held investments in the shipping company. And so that's what's taken people, I think, mostly by surprise, that he's actually retained these interests, despite being in government, A, in a position of authority over industry, and obviously shipping is a very important part of industry, and B, retaining this link to influential Russians when he's part of a government imposing sanctions on some of them.
You also looked into people who are big political donors, some on the Republican side, at least one on the Democratic side. I want to throw some names at you that you've reported on, not all household names in this case. Warren Stevens, can you talk about him and what we've learned about him from these papers?
Sure. Warren Stevens is an Arkansas-based finance guy, essentially, and although he's not a household name, he has been a very big backer of Republican candidates over the years. And what we learned is he's actually the hidden co-owner of a payday lending firm, one of these companies that gives people short-term loans, often with very high interest rates. And why that's particularly interesting is Mr. Stevens has backed politicians who are trying to dismantle a government regulator of that industry. There's this thing called the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, and it's actually suing Warren Stevens' payday lender. And we've never known that he was a co-owner of this company. He's been funding politicians who are trying to kind of undermine and bring down this regulator while being involved in the industry himself.
So this is something one could do with these offshore accounts, be a secret owner of a public business.
That's right. You can, in many different jurisdictions, have ownership stakes in companies and ensure that those companies are just not publicly disclosed. There are some jurisdictions, you know, these jurisdictions do vary somewhat between, in terms of what they disclose to the public and to the press, but some of them ensure almost total secrecy. You just cannot get hold of any documents that reveal the ownership of a company. And if you've got a payday lending company or another business that may operate in the United States, it may be owned by a series of more opaque companies which end offshore.
And then Robert Mercer, a little better known. He has close ties to Steve Bannon. He was involved in President Trump's campaign indirectly in many ways. And he's very wealthy, and his name has come up in regard to these papers. What have we learned about Robert Mercer?
So Robert Mercer's family has a family foundation, which it uses to make philanthropic donations. Some of these are to kind of conservative-leaning research groups, and some of those research groups have funded Stephen Bannon, who, as many people will know, worked in Donald Trump's White House until recently. And what we found in these documents is that Robert Mercer's foundation is using a Bermuda-based investment vehicle to avoid tax on huge investment profits that he's making from hedge fund investments. So what it means is, in simple terms, his foundation saves money. It doesn't pay tax on millions of dollars of investment profits that it makes. And that allows it to give more money to people like Stephen Bannon, who can then use it to make political films, political books, which are critical of Hillary Clinton, and essentially use this offshore-funded vehicle to exert political influence.
And do I have this right? This foundation of the Mercer family, a lot of the hedge fund it's buying into is the hedge fund operated and owned by Robert Mercer. Is that right?
That's absolutely right. It gets more complicated because, yeah, he himself owns the hedge fund. It's named Renaissance Technologies. And as you say, he uses his own private foundation to invest in his own hedge fund. And then when it makes money, he avoids tax on the returns. So as you suggest, you know, that is a kind of strange, unusual setup. And to a lot of people, I think it's slightly troubling.
Democrats are not completely omitted here either. You talked about Democratic donor James Simons in your reporting. What can you tell us about him?
That's right. Well, James Simons is actually the founder of Renaissance Technologies, Robert Mercer's hedge fund. But James Simons is more of a Democrat. He has donated to lots of Democrats over the years and put actually $11 million behind Hillary Clinton's campaign and sort of supporting groups to her campaign in 2016. And what we found about James Simons was that for several decades, he's actually been building a huge trust fund on Bermuda, which is this Atlantic tax haven. And the trust fund he's built there is worth at least $8 billion. That's billion with a B. And this was just unknown to people before now. He has sort of secretly built this up. And we got hold of documents in this leak that give a lot of detail about the trust fund and how it makes its money and how it distributes money.
Do we have a sense of how much money governments in the United States and elsewhere are not getting because of the use of these tax havens?
Well, it's incredibly difficult to know just purely because of the lack of transparency that we discussed earlier. But certainly campaigners argue that this is in the hundreds of billions of dollars of each year worldwide being lost in terms of tax revenues that might have otherwise be taken in.
And is there any kind of pressure now on leaders in countries that are losing out on this to try to bring that money back, close loopholes, that kind of thing?
There's a little bit of pressure. I think you see liberals on the Democratic side and independents like Bernie Sanders calling for inquiries to be set up and for action to be taken to dissuade and deter U.S. individuals and corporations from moving money offshore. There's Senator Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island and a Representative Lloyd Doggett of Texas, each Congress for the last few years, they actually have introduced a bill which would try to tackle some of these issues, to close the loopholes and to stop some of these strategies. But actually, they've attracted very little support for this bill every time they've introduced it. And they're trying again now, and they're saying that, you know, these disclosures show just how much that is needed. And I guess it's going to be interesting to see whether they'll gather any more support than they have done before.
John, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's John Swain, senior reporter for The Guardian. He joined us to take a closer look at the Paradise Papers and which Americans in politics have been connected to them. President Trump is in the middle of a 12-day trip to Asia. Countries like Japan, South Korea, China, Vietnam, and the Philippines all made the list of places for the president to visit. He's leaving China for Vietnam tomorrow, wrapping up his trip with a visit to the Philippines. Jessica Trisco-Darden is an assistant professor in the School of International Service at American University and a Jean Kirkpatrick Fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. She's here to talk about that trip so far and what's to come. Jessica, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me, Rob.
Big picture, Jessica, as the president's making this trip, what are we watching for when it comes to U.S. Relations with these countries in Asia?
Well, I think one of the most important lessons that's come out of this Asia trip so far is that the president very much thinks of America's relations abroad in terms of his personal relationships with other leaders. So it's not necessarily about U.S. relations with Japan. It's really about President Trump's relationship with Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. And I think that has been something that we've seen across countries. Today, he discussed the good chemistry that he has with President Xi. And in other instances, we've seen kind of a lot of discussion of friendship and camaraderie and close relations. So that's one major thing that's come out of this. But, sorry, go ahead.
Well, I wanted to ask if that's a legitimate way to think about diplomacy. Does that personal relationship between two world leaders really make a difference on the world stage?
I think it does, in the sense that President Trump was very consistent in his rhetoric on the campaign trail that he was going to be doing the negotiating, right? He was going to tear up bad deals. He was going to renegotiate. And so this language that he's using is very consistent with that. I think combined with some of the staffing challenges that we've seen at the U.S. State Department, it remains to be seen what the long-term effects of this approach will be on American diplomacy abroad. But what he's saying in Asia over the past several days is broadly consistent with his personal approach to diplomacy.
I want to give a listen to President Trump making this remark on China when it comes to trade between the two countries.
Both the United States and China will have a more prosperous future if we can achieve a level economic playing field. Right now, unfortunately, it is a very one-sided and unfair one. But I don't blame China. After all, who can blame a country for being able to take advantage of another country for the benefit of its citizens? I give China great credit.
And President Trump went on to blame his predecessors as president for these, what he calls, bad trade deals. So it's a different tone. He still doesn't like our trade situation with China, but he's not blaming China as much as he might have on the campaign trail.
Again, I think this is very consistent with everything that President Trump has done so far in terms of diplomacy on the international stage. He's not going to roll into China and start lecturing the Chinese leadership about human rights abuses or about trade practices. He's focused on big picture items that directly impact American citizens. So, while I think that the president's general fixation on the budget deficit, which he also discussed a lot in that speech, doesn't really give us the full picture on trade between the United States and China, he did raise other very important and real issues that need to be tackled, such as intellectual property theft and Chinese domestic subsidies. But he did this in a way that was really non-threatening to the Chinese leadership. And I think that that might be a good approach.
Could something good come out of this to help with trade imbalances between the U.S. and China?
Well, that remains to be seen. I think there is an argument that if we see some movement in terms of domestic subsidies and other issues within China that affect the country's competitiveness on international markets, that would be a great outcome. But I think that the U.S. trade balance is really tied to kind of his America First agenda. And it's something that we're going to hear over and over and over again. And it's something that we saw in terms of kind of the arms sales and promotion of U.S. arms sales that was also part of this trip.
We're talking to Jessica Trisco-Darden from American University, looking at President Trump's diplomatic tour in Asia. Now, you mentioned the president not raising human rights issues. People have raised some eyebrows. President Trump, in a tweet, congratulated Chinese leader Xi Jinping for his recent, quote, great political victory. We heard in the news talking about China's pride in their leader. People are saying, some critics saying, not only is he not bringing up human rights issues, he seems to be praising someone who's consolidating power that is sometimes used abusively.
We've seen the president make similar statements with regards to other world leaders. So President Duterte, who he'll be meeting later on this trip, also President Erdogan in Turkey. I don't think it reflects necessarily a particular perspective of the president's regarding human rights. I think that he sees himself as a strong leader, as a strong businessman, and so he looks to these attributes of strength in other leaders and kind of sees himself as akin to that. So I think that while we do need to be doing more to push China on human rights issues, that this wasn't necessarily the forum for that, and it certainly wasn't the forum for that for this U.S. president.
And, of course, North Korea is definitely a shadow hanging over this whole trip. President Trump has been calling on China to do more when it comes to North Korea, to stop supporting North Korea, to help with international sanctions on North Korea. What do you make of what the president has done on this trip in particular when it comes to North Korea?
Well, I think it's interesting because North Korea is an area in which we're getting much more of the morality-driven or values-driven language. He told this narrative about how terrible life was in North Korea and kind of extolled China and Russia to do more, to stop cooperating with this really coercive, really suppressive regime. And I think that that's a narrative that appeals to everyone, to the United States, to those who would partner with the United States in bringing about denuclearization in North Korea. But I also think that the complete denuclearization of North Korea is something that would be a very complicated process. And to the degree that President Trump has withheld criticism from some of the leaders that he's meeting on this trip, that might also be part of a strategy to better deal with the North Korea issue. So there is certainly a prioritization of what issues we're willing to push at this time.
We're talking to Jessica Trisco-Darden from American University and the American Enterprise Institute, looking at President Trump's visit to Asia. You can join in now at 800-642-1234. What do you think about what the president has said and done on this tour of Asian countries? What kind of relationship should the U.S. have with countries like China? Are you worried about trade issues? How about North Korea? Call in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We pick up our conversation now about President Trump's trip to Asia. Jessica Trisco-Darden is with us from American University. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What kind of relationship do you hope President Trump could build with these Asian countries he's visiting? What do you think about the president's trip there so far? What are you hoping for when it comes to trade, to North Korea, to human rights? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll go to your calls now. Tom is with us in Ashland. Tom, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What do you think, Tom?
Well, you know, Jessica mentioned just a little earlier arms sales, and I have been thinking for a couple of days now that the primary reason for Donald Trump's visit to these countries is to sell them arms. Just, you know, there are little news bites that just for a couple of seconds they'll say, by the way, Japan just bought this many billion dollars in arms, South Korea just bought this many billion dollars in arms, and I know that that is helping Donald Trump's friends and but I also am concerned about what sort of message this is going to send to North Korea when we are helping arm all of the nations that are so close in proximity. Thanks for taking my call, and I'll listen to Answers Off the Air.
Tom, thanks for that call. And President Trump had said something to the effect of Japan could help ensure its security by buying more American arms. Can you talk about that aspect of this trip?
Absolutely. Thank you for that excellent question. On this topic, there was a recent article in Politico that discussed the fact that the U.S. is already the global leader in weapons exports. We have a great industry. And it cited some State Department officials who really said that we're trying to increase the competitiveness of American trade and expand that market. I think that's the commercial argument for why arms sales have been part of this Asia trip. But there's also a kind of diplomatic aspect to it. While he was on the campaign trail, President Trump talked a lot about burden sharing and how essentially his position was that American allies weren't standing up and doing enough to provide for their own defense. And I think this focus on arms sales is one way for allies to demonstrate that they're serious about strengthening their capacity and they're taking the president's call to do more seriously.
Thanks for that call, Tom, at 800-642-1234. Jessica, the president will end his trip in the Philippines, and I want to go there now. Could you talk about the current state of relations between the United States and the Philippines?
So it's complicated. The U.S.-Philippine relationship is complicated. It's a very long relationship, but our kind of close alliance with the Philippines came under some stress while President Obama was in office. President Duterte of the Philippines didn't really feel like Obama was according him the necessary level of respect, and he himself said some pretty nasty, inappropriate things about President Obama. This really changed when President Trump came to power. The two had a very friendly conversation where President Trump invited President Duterte to the White House. That phone call occurred on April 30th. But less than a month later, on May 23rd, we see that President Duterte actually declared and imposed martial law in the southern Philippines while he was on his way back from a trip to Russia. So President Duterte has really been playing the field in terms of his global relationships. He's spent time in Russia. He's been forging closer alliance with China. And so this has led many to kind of question whether the U.S.-Philippine relationship is as enduring as we once thought.
I want to bring on another caller now. Jim is with us in Rice Lake. Jim, hi.
My concern about Trump is his general isolation of the United States. For example, now that Syria, that great democratic society, has joined the Paris Environmental Accords, we're now the only country on the face of the earth that hasn't signed on to trying to deal with climate change. And I'm also concerned since Trump just, you know, ideologically rejected the Trans-Siberian Economic Program, that, again, we are, you know, can our economic partners in the region think they can rely upon us? I'd be interested in your guest comments.
Jessica, thanks. The Trans-Pacific Partnership, I think he was talking about there, and people, supporters of that, there were a lot of critics, but supporters said the Trans-Pacific Partnership would give us connections there. If we don't sign on, that means China is the trade leader in the region.
So the Trans-Pacific Partnership is an interesting question because during the kind of run-up to the presidential election, we didn't have many people who were strong advocates for the TPP. So the U.S. withdrawal from that agreement, you know, didn't really come as a big shock. However, the other 11 nations that are part of that agreement have continued on in it, and indeed we expect an announcement tomorrow regarding the future of the TPP 11. So I would agree that there is some sense that the United States is not fully on board with international agreements, that multilateralism is being undervalued. But a positive kind of interpretation of this is that we are perhaps opening the space to create better deals. So many critics of the TPP said it had too much protectionism in it for U.S. industries, that it required some of our partners to do things that they couldn't realistically do. So maybe there will be down the road a better agreement to be had.
And briefly, as we start to wrap up, Jessica, what are you hoping when this trip is done? What are you hoping the president accomplishes?
I'm hoping that the message that he's sending to our allies in Asia Pacific, that we are committed to our longstanding security obligations in the region, is one that is heard and one that is sincerely spoken. And we see signs of that in their joint statement. President Moon and President Trump both mentioned the South Korea-U.S. relationship. President Moon, in fact, mentioned it over and over and over again, referring to the U.S. Republic of Korea alliance, whereas President Trump used more the language of relationship and friendship. But these alliances are the key to security and stability in Asia Pacific. And I'd like to see the president really reinforce that is one of his beliefs.
We'll leave it there for now. Jessica, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Jessica Trisco-Darden is an assistant professor in the School of International Service at American University. She's also a Jean Kirkpatrick Fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. She joined us to talk about President Trump's trip to Asia, a lot of diplomatic meetings going on with leaders of China, Japan, South Korea, and other countries.